It is our pleasure this evening to have Teresa Kubisak and Gabe Huck with us to share their memoir, Never Can I Write of Damascus, When Syria Became Our Home. This evening's event is co-sponsored by Neighbors for Peace and the Peace and Justice Committee of St. Nicholas Church. And Bookends and Beginnings is selling copies of the book right in the back of the room. You can grab a copy at the end of the program after the questions and answers and everything. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Teresa and Gabe.
We welcome you, and we're so glad to see people from Neighbors for Peace and St. Nick's and the library and Bookends and Beginnings. And I think we're really overwhelmed, and I'm trying not to cry, to see some of you that are here tonight. It's really amazing, although our hair is grayer and whiter. So we're going to begin tonight with a song. Who would like to help Gabe pass out handouts? Oh, Mary. On the front of your handout is a song. We're not going to explain it. We'll just sing. I'll teach you the chorus, and we invite you to sing on every time the chorus or refrain appears. If you want to sing on the verses, that's okay too. Okay, it's going to be kind of a slow, what can I say, repetition of the refrain, like this. Go into the Fertile Crescent, cradle of civilization, land between two rivers, we're going to Mesopotamia. Can you do it? That's going to be it. So that was for just listening, and now we'll do it together, and then we'll jump into the verses. Here we go. Go into the Fertile Crescent, cradle of civilization, land between two rivers, go into Mesopotamia, the law of Hammurabi, the wheel of the Assyrians, irrigation and the Sumerians, the gardens of the Babylonians. We're going to the Fertile Crescent, the cradle of civilization, land between two rivers, going to Mesopotamia. Architecture and geometry, mathematics and libraries, the vaulted arch and cuneiform, Gilgamesh and epic poetry. We're going to the Fertile Crescent, cradle of civilization, land between two rivers, going to Mesopotamia, the land of the prophet Jonah and Abraham and Sarah, Ezekiel and Daniel, people of the Holy Book, House of Wisdom Universities, translations and calligraphy, three religions live in harmony, and a shining city named for peace. We're going to the Fertile Crescent, cradle of civilization, uranium, congenital malformations, children dying of leukemia, isolated, no economy. We're going to the Fertile Crescent, cradle of civilization, land between two rivers, going to Mesopotamia. Water sickness and the stolen air. Endless sanctions, how they grind and tear. Mass destruction's what we've got here. For a dozen years, the world's not cared. We're going to the Fertile Crescent, cradle of civilization, land between two rivers. Going to Mesopotamia, we're going to Iraq. We'd like to invite you now to just put things down and maybe breathe in and breathe out, and we'll have a moment of silence for the people of the Fertile Crescent and the people of the Middle East. Thank you.
Usually we turn off the images during the presentation, but I don't know how to turn them off, and I don't want to, and then we put them on again afterwards if people want to watch, so enjoy them, and if it's a distraction, you know, it probably deserves to be. So I want to just say that on this handout, which we use for the song and generally not much else, but just to say when you take it home, there are some useful things here. The three maps, the one on the front and the two inside, are, you know, Xeroxes, but from maps in our book, which there's seven in all, just three of them are here. But you're seeing the whole of the Fertile Crescent area on the front, and then on the page behind that, Mohayim Yarmouk, which is where we lived our second and third years in Damascus. It is the Palestinian area, one of the Palestinian areas from 48. This one actually about in the early 50s was laid out and gradually grew up with all the street names being cities in Palestine, which people had fled from. It was a wonderful place to live. It's, from what we know, it's basically gone at this point. Damascus has been spared much, but not some of these outlying areas. We'll talk about that later. And the one across from it on the third page has a couple of other places that we live. But what we wanted to do was give a sense for how this city flows down the mountain, the last mountain from the Mediterranean, really, in terms of nation states, from Lebanon into Syria. And then levels out and becomes this fertile, wonderful plain that was Damascus, where from this little river called the Barada, which you'll find in the Book of Kings somewhere, the canals were built from very early times, like 4,000 years ago already. They were building canals to spread that springtime snow melt out to the east of Damascus in the area that sometimes you see in the press today called the Ghouta, which is has many little towns in it now too, but it's still this paradise that is Damascus. And from the south of Damascus are the mountains that are in the Bible are called Mount Hermon. It's called Jebel al-Sheikh in Arabic, the hills of the like sheikhs there with their white snow tops on. And that also is an extremely fertile land. Then you move beyond that to the east to the desert that runs through the rest of Syria and into Iraq. And because I always forget to say it at the end, maybe the most important page is the back page. Further reading. Read, read, read. We have to today. There's nothing else that we can find, you know, and people are publishing and the people are who know and spend great time researching and are writing. So we put some of the books and then a couple of new ones that are from the bibliography of our book. It's yours from here on. Okay. Why were we in Syria from 2005 to 2012? Basically because what that song was about, Iraq, and what had happened after the first Gulf War in 1991, January, when the U.S. Military drove the Iraqi military out of Kuwait, where they had been for 6 months. Kuwait used to be in the same batch of provinces of the Ottoman Empire as the other provinces that were made to be Iraq, but the British and French decided that province should be its own country and created Kuwait, as well as a few other things along the way. So the four trips that we made to Iraq during the sanctions were about people in the U.S., not like us before that, not knowing that those sanctions went on and on and on after being created to punish Iraq for invading Kuwait and to last only until Iraq was out of Kuwait. The U.S. insisted at the U.N. that they go on until this, until that, until the other thing, weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist and all that. And they were the tightest, most complete sanctions that had ever been used anywhere. And by the mid-90s, it was becoming apparent that something had to be done, and there was a big struggle called to establish oil for food, which some will remember, that was an effort to at least try to feed Iraq. But even that was largely controlled by the U.S. So when Voices in the Wilderness began to make trips there in the late 90s, we signed on and in 1999 went for the first time with a group of people into Iraq and meeting people, meeting doctors, meeting people who were in the hospital, meeting families, meeting people in churches, meeting people in mosques, schools, wherever. And coming back to give talks, which probably some of you attended, on the damage those sanctions were doing. In the beginning, that was before anybody was thinking about Iraq again. After 9/11 and the attack on our attack on Afghanistan, Iraq was next in line for no very good reason, but it was. And so it was back in the news again, although the effects of the sanctions were still a little talked about. But they are what stayed with us, as well as shock and awe, which followed the sanctions in 2003. And all of it made worse by the fact that while we were preparing to drive the Iraq army out of Kuwait in 91, the U.S. freely bombed the whole of Iraq, especially all of the things like electrical plants, sewer treatment plants, railroads, the electricity, the whole means of existing. So when they were into the sanctions and the absence of food and anything coming in, the old stuff wasn't working anymore anyhow. It had all been bombed, but we never really heard about that here very much. And only after 2003, when the U.S. invaded and occupied, did all that come to an end. So our thing was, what do we do now? Because we had become very much involved in what our country had done to Iraq and how little attention and how little understanding there was of that here. So we moved to Damascus, not knowing what kind of a project might emerge. And for the first 2 years, what emerged was studying Arabic with a teacher and getting to know the place, getting to see as the number of Iraqis seeking refuge in Syria grew, and eventually to more than 1 million, and most of them in Damascus. There were no refugee camps at all in that period. Iraqis were allowed in with barely a question asked, unlike any other surrounding country. They could come into Syria. They came in, they brought what little money they could, rented a place, and there they were. So that's where we went, to Damascus, and began to get to know Iraqis in those years. So we had in our mind that whatever we did should have some obvious character of reparation about it. Not a Band-Aid, but something that says we did great damage and we want to do something that to make reparations to you. It's not a popular word among U.S. officialdom, but that's what we called it.
And we called it Iraqi Student Project. And we kind of didn't know what we were doing, but we really wanted to do it. And a few weeks ago, somebody at Mennonite Central Committee at the UN, Doug Hostetter, that you might remember, said they did it on faith and a shoestring. So I feel that the faith we had was Neighbors for Peace upholding us and sending us out, people at St. Nick's upholding us, sending us out, our friends from where we were involved in our work that were upholding us, and we never felt afraid or daunted. We just somehow tried to do it. So we tried first to identify students who already could speak English, and if they were fluent English speakers, then we would give them a language assessment with a rubric from 1 to 8, hoping that if they fell in the 6 to 8 category, it meant they're ready for a program where we could get them ready to come to college. So our idea was, what's the best thing the U.S. has to offer is liberal arts education. What if we find colleges, match them up with students, get scholarships, form support groups, have people be in these support groups that will be the emotional, financial, spiritual friends for the students who come. And the wonderful thing that happened is how the Iraqi students who came, because over 60 ended up coming, how they affected the lives of the Americans, how they changed people who thought that they were helping some Iraqi kid and then end up building this relationship and learning more about Iraq, or maybe learning more about Islam or other religions from Iraq. So that model of support groups and colleges really worked great. And what we did on the ground in Syria, we turned our apartment into a type of school, and the students called it Beit ISP, or ISP House. And we made soup and fed kids, especially when they were sick. We did film and food on Saturdays, and Gabe showed films like Eyes on the Prize or A Force More Powerful about nonviolence, and kids would eat falafel sandwiches and look at the films. And one effective thing we did in Eyes on the Prize, when we were looking at the civil rights time, maybe about 6 Saturdays in a row, we had 3x5 cards, and I gave cards out, and I said to the students, okay, you're going to be Diane Nash. Watch this film, and at the end, you're going to talk about her. Okay, you're going to be Stokely. Here's your card. Watch. And at the end of the film, in your episode, you're going to tell us more about him. And it really brought the students into the film, and we supplemented that with materials from Oxford University Press. So it wasn't an ESL program. As we said, we already gave kids an assessment and tried to take people who were ready to jump into a college prep for a liberal arts college, and all the teachers were volunteers. So we recruited teachers at places like the British Council, and they were paid well, and they had insurance, and they had a stipend for their apartment, but they loved teaching our kids because our students were so motivated, knowing if they did well in our program, they could get a scholarship and maybe come to Loyola, DePaul, Bard, Smith, Gonzaga, St. Mary's in Omaha, Berea, Goucher, University of Oregon, so many places where the students came. The teachers, in many cases, were folks on a Fulbright who came to Syria to learn a really easy form of Arabic compared to like Egyptian Arabic that might have a different accent. Some were Fulbrighters, some were students who came to do research for their PhD programs, maybe from colleges in London like SOAS. So we were really blessed to have fantastic teachers who just volunteered. And I would say that my experience at working at Baker Demonstration School or National Lewis really helped because we did teacher trainings and all kinds of things to help the teachers. And it was such a wonderful time. But we had to, of course, do a standardized test, the TOEFL, which was a test of English fluency. And we had to learn all about it. And we had to learn about visas. And we practiced for visa interviews so that our students would be well prepared when they got up to the window for their visa. And we did mock interviews. And they had their folder with all of their papers. So if the officer said, How do I know that this will be paid for? The student at Loyola could say, here's a letter from my host family. Here's a letter from Iraqi Student Project. Here's my acceptance letter to Loyola, to have all their ducks in a row so they were able to be really wonderful at the interview site. We told the students, you might have to wait 3 or 4 hours when you're in there, so bring a book to read. And one student who since graduated from dental school at UPenn was holding a book called Farewell to Manzanar. And the officer said, hello, how are you this morning? What's your name? He said, I'm Ali Rod. What are you reading? Oh, I'm reading Farewell to Manzanar. Do you know this book? No, I really, what's it about? It's about when your country took Japanese Americans in 1945 and put them in internment camps. So we also read other literature like Fahrenheit 451, Flowers for Algernon, Martian Chronicles, 1984, books that you needed to read in high school here so that when you got to college, you had a common language of literature. And I taught writer's workshop and the lit circles. And looking back, what a glorious time of learning that was. And the important thing is we never took money from any students or families. We didn't pay anyone who was in Damascus who worked with us. And we were totally transparent. So there was a small magazine called What's On, and it was published in Damascus, and they did an article on us and some students. And in What's On, at the end of the article, it had our name and our email and our phone number. And we thought, here we are, we're totally transparent, nothing to hide. And I think that really was important for our success.
Those two steps, never taking money and never doing anything that wasn't totally out in the open, were our answer to don't become an NGO, because it's hard to become an NGO in Syria anyway. And we just decided we couldn't wait the time it would take and maybe never even succeed. But if we did those two things, it would work. And basically it did. We were not bothered. We were not harassed. We renewed our, every month or 2 months, our residency in...
For 7 years
in Syria. And they would say, yeah, you're still a tourist? You know, when we say, yeah, there's a lot here. You know, we've never been to Palmyra yet. And so, oh, okay. Stamped the renewal. Okay.
I've got to talk about these books briefly.
Okay.
So many of you know that Gabe Huck had a great career as a publisher. And so, of course, he published books in Damascus. And it was the books of our students' writing. So I'm going to let him talk a little bit about this. The first book is here, and this book was published when it already was the time of violence. And the students came to the factory, to the publishing house. You should tell this part.
Well, yeah. In the beginning, it was just to gather some of the fine poetry and prose that they had written during the year and put it in a little booklet. And at the first year or two, we did it the way most books were being done in Syria, and that's a Xerox and a, you know, all around Damascus University, there were these shops that made the textbooks. But by the last 2 years, we found a wonderful printing house in the basement of a big building downtown, and we worked with those guys. It was wonderful working with them. But by that time, it was into beginning, it's 2011 March is when the violence started in Syria. That would have been in the summer of 2011 and in the summer of 2012 that we did the books. But they are really very interesting collections. There's hardly, except the ones I hold in my hand, any left that aren't somewhere today in somebody's possession. I'm thinking about whether we should do them again. But it's wonderful writing flowing right out of the writer's workshop. From the beginning of our time there, we tried to write letters in the beginning every month and just send them by email to, you know, our families and friends, and the list grew over the years. And when we were finished and we were being encouraged to, well, the person who most encouraged us, I shouldn't act like there's a whole bunch who did, but there was a good, two good friends, Bashar and Hala. He, an electrical engineer, and she,
oncologist,
who said, who have been here a lot in the U.S. because both of their grown children live here. And they would say, you know, write your book. You know, Americans do not know or understand Syria and Syrians. And you do because you live there. And that's what really moved us to pull those letters out of the computer and so we could remember, and but write it more as a kind of memoir. We made up a kind of a different, it's not a strictly chronological, it skips around, but the book is based on the four areas of Damascus where we lived during those 7 years, and which are here in the maps there. So I like to tell people, where did this title come from? Never Can I Write of Damascus, when Syria became our home. Well, the Never Can I Write of Damascus came about in this way. We went with the students the second last year, I guess, before there was any thought of a book. We visited an art exhibit by an Iraqi calligrapher in Damascus, and he was there, and the students spent a good amount of time talking with the calligrapher. Well, Teresa and I looked at the artwork and decided we wanted to buy this one piece, which we did. And the next couple of weeks in one of the classes, we looked at that two tiny stanzas of Arabic poetry. Talked about, now how would you translate this? How would you make a poem in English, not just a translation in English? It was an interesting exercise. When it came time for a book, there were all kinds of titles being batted around by the publisher and so on. But at some point we remembered that piece of calligraphy and the translation that the students had finally arrived at, and put the Arabic and the English of the first few stanzas of the poem here. Never can I write of Damascus without my hands becoming a trellis for her jasmine. Nor can my mouth utter that name without savoring the juices of her apricot, pomegranate, mulberry, and quince. Nor can I remember her without 1,000 doves landing on the wall of my memories, and 1,000 doves take flight. In the very back of the book, there's a few more lines. Damascus, it's not a picture from paradise. It is paradise. And it's not a copy of the poem. It is the poem. And the poet's name is Nizar Kabani, a Syrian poet, well known for decades of poetry writing. I think he died in the 90s. Much of it published, not, some translated. But when we went to seek permission for this, we found that this particular poem was in none of his books. It was, in fact, online in his handwriting. And the most, to an American, amazing thing was that Syrians told us, they were shocked it wasn't in a book somewhere, because every Syrian knows that poem. It says something about the role of poetry in that life. So that became the title. The arches here, the space here, is the Khan Pasha in the old city of Damascus. It goes by once in a while in that series of photos up there from all different angles. If you catch one of them, watch the rest, because everywhere you step in that room, what was this? A mosque? No. It was a warehouse and a hotel. It was where people on the Silk Road could stay a few nights, store their goods inside, give a place for their animals to sleep inside, and it is now and was as it was then, in the midst of one of the busy souks, the sales places, the markets of Damascus. Oh, all right. Yeah, you're supposed to do a little reading at one of these things, and this is just a little bit, the streets of Damascus. Our Damascus is life on the streets. It is shopkeepers sitting alone or in pairs or groups, always a steaming pot of tea nearby and some sort of gas or electric device. It is men playing backgammon, with or without an audience. It is crowds of children off to school and home from school. It is the sellers of street food on corners, with the sounds of them coming, calling out and to come see what they have as they go through the lanes on bicycles, with carts behind, or with a donkey pulling the cart, ears of corn boiling away in a kettle nestled in their cart, or perhaps the amazing banana on flatbread garnished with tahini and chocolate sauce and a variety of other toppings, or the cold mulberry juice in season. Everything in season and not out of season. Life on Damascus streets is the processions to the cemetery and the public mourning tent near the home. It is the one-man tea service who comes right to your park bench. It is the sellers of books and posters outside the university, and the souk selling vegetables and fruit just in from the Ghouta, or 2 dozen kinds of olives from the Dead Cities area southwest of Aleppo. It is near professional skateboarders zooming past on the sidewalk. It's the man selling hot fool from a great stove on wheels, beans cooking with olive oil and lemon and sprinkled with sumac. It is the homeless cats, and all the cats of Damascus are homeless, and they like it that way, who share their city with us. It is coming around a corner and stopping short because you realize you came around that corner 3 minutes ago. So how did you get back here again? Because you thought you were walking in a straight line. It is for one long season each year, the sight and full fragrance of jasmine, the city's widely and wildly growing flower. It is the men with their rolling garbage cans who pick up after all of us. And until we left Damascus, it was still possible to walk those streets without any trepidation, any hour of day or night. Also in...
I want to ask, can you raise your hand if you've been in a mosque before? Yay, that is great. Okay, keep visiting. But Gabe's going to share a short sidebar about one of our visits to the mosque.
I would like to, if I spot at any point that we're getting pictures of the Umayyad Mosque where this happened, the great mosque in Damascus, built in the 8th century, I'll call your attention to it. But that's what we're talking about here. And but I want to start with how the chapter on the mosque begins. Amin Rihani, a Lebanese-American literary figure and early theorist of Arab nationalism, who died in 1940, described what might be the essence of a mosque. And so this quote is from him. "Of all the places of worship I know, and I have lugged my unshrived soul to and my weary limbs into many a foreign temple, the mosque has always impressed me as being by far the most democratic and the most unstinted in its varied hospitalities. There is nothing in it or in its economy to flatter the rich or offend the poor, to repel the weary or distract the devout. It is a clear open space, unencumbered and untaxed, where you can come and stay when you please and as long as you please." And that's what we found, at least the Umayyad Mosque, to be. Always people in there, all ages, you know, some tourists, but certainly a small number compared to those who would be in there, resting, praying, reading, talking, sitting, having a picnic with their children, inside or in the courtyard. This was one of our experiences there. We had gone to the mosque knowing that one of the calls to prayer would soon be heard, and in the next 10 minutes at that mosque, hundreds of people would all of a sudden appear through the doorways, taking off the shoes, and men lining up against the south wall facing Mecca, and women in rows behind them. And a row in that mosque could have 200 people in it. But not everybody got there on time. On one visit to the Umayyad Mosque, perhaps two years or more into our Damascus time, we were there as the afternoon prayer began. Then near us, something amazing. Two boys, perhaps brothers, maybe 8 and 10 years old, came hurrying up toward the lines of men making the prayer together. No adults seemed to be with them. They stopped, they stood close to each other, as everyone does in the line, facing Mecca, and they joined in the postures of those already at prayer. They seemed to know every word and movement and silence of the prayer. And so they prayed with the others to the end, their lips moving, performing the kneeling and bowing and touching their heads to the ground, totally wrapped in their prayer. All of this is not unusual in the mosque. There are many times young people who know the prayer by heart. Not what caught our eye. What caught our eye was this. The two boys were dressed in complete Superman outfits. Blue tops, the giant red S on the yellow diamond, blue leggings, long red capes. They had no self-consciousness about this at all. All their attention seemed on their prayer, just like those around them. That's what the mosque would be. Okay, one more short story of mosque and prayer. And this was from the writing one of our students did one day about the trip that she made with, she and her mother and sister fled from Iraq, taking a bus to Syria by way of Kirkuk and Mosul. The bus broke down. They and the 40 other passengers, these were the days when thousands of Iraqis were leaving for Syria every day, had to find shelter for the night. They all entered a mosque in Mosul, still strangers and probably mistrustful given the violence they had all experienced in Baghdad. And so she writes this. It was awfully cold that night, and the mosque was not any warmer. Every family took a spot to sit in and sleep, but it was too cold to fall asleep. Back then, no one knew anything other than their own families. But somehow people started to get closer to each other and talk. I don't know how it ended up in a big circle, so close. I thought it was the cold that made us approach each other for warmth. Everyone was talking about their stories, and soon we knew each other. There was a lot of laughter and tears as well. After hearing everyone's story, I realized something that shocked me, and I was wondering if I was the only or the first one who could see it. What I realized was that we were Shiite, Sunni, Christians, all together in one mosque. And no one really cared about that, but instead we were just a big family trying to make it through together. You could hear our talks and laughter from a distance. I felt I wanted to get up and tell everyone to notice. What are the odds, I said to myself. Could it be the thing that set us apart once is reuniting us again?
We really loved our time in Syria, and the part of the book that I'm going to read is my favorite thing to do on Sunday, next to going to St. Nick's. The hammam, the public bath. The first time I stepped into the hammam in the old city, I pushed aside a heavy Persian carpet that was tacked up above the lintel of the doorway to provide privacy. I entered a huge mosque-like, white-domed space with an ancient brass chandelier suspended from the center of the dome, hovering above a rose-scented fountain. Three sides of the room had raised platforms with wooden sofas covered with beautiful Middle Eastern carpets, pillows, and cushions. Small, delicately carved tables, silver trays, and draped textiles made me feel as if I had entered an Orientalist painting by Matisse. Three cozy areas provided places to sit, relax, read, undress or dress, and have tea after the ritual of the bath. Colored glass in the dome above muted the light that seemed to dance around the room and mixed with the happy voices of the women. The largest room was warm, and there were heavy stone basins on the floor around the perimeter. Women were sitting on small wooden stools, rinsing off at basins or washing their hair or bathing children. In this room, patrons could lie or sit on the marble floor and receive a vigorous scrub down with olive oil soap and jute from Sahar and Najwa. Inlaid stones graced one of the walls, reminding me of the traditional quilt pattern called Ohio Star. It felt magical for all of us women to be using such a beautiful structure. One Sunday, two Damascene grandmothers came in with their grown daughters and granddaughters. When the granddaughters pushed their way through the heavy suspended carpet that cloaks the doorway, they gasped, delighted to see the bright dome, the fountain, a goldfish tank, lanterns, and plants. The grandmothers handed bags of food to the mothers, and they spread out a pre-bath picnic. Later, as they all undressed together before entering the inner rooms, I reflected on the ways that women reveal their attitudes toward their bodies here in the freedom of the hammam, and what an opportunity to observe how generations relate to one another. Another special friend at the Bakri hammam was Najwa's baby. Najwa had worked throughout her pregnancy giving massages and scrubs, and soon after the birth of her son, Ali, she was back at work, bringing him along with her. He became the delight of the hammam. When he was first strong enough to lift his head off the floor under the dome of colored glass, he looked like a little turtle. Over the months, I was able to hold him and see him grow and watch him learn to crawl. He sometimes sat in a little walker and scooted his way around the fountain. When he learned to talk, his mother taught him to call me Teta, Grandma, which touched me greatly. That respect for elders in Syrian culture was a grace to me in the form of this child. That hammam closed and it never opened again, but I found another one. Mustafa, a young woman with a hearty laugh, managed the front desk. We spoke Arabic together, and when she wanted to make sure I understood her, especially with her view about the political situation, she switched to English. Lena was the matriarch of the hammam, and I mostly saw her brewing coffee, making tea, and telling stories. Two other women were responsible for the massages, Shakira, who committed herself to minimizing the pain I felt in my hip, and Ahmed, who had a beautiful voice as she sang in the inner massage rooms of the hammam. I would miss the vigorous massage from Shakira on the days that she was absent, but it was worth it once in a while to experience the astounding voice and vibrato of Ahmed, her voice amplified by the dome in the warm room. Mustafa was excited when nonviolent demonstrations broke out in Damascus in 2011. She wanted wider job opportunities for herself and her two brothers, all college graduates. She wanted a better educational system for her son, and she wanted economic growth in Syria. And she added, "I love our president. My son would die for him." As the violence in Syria escalated, the early morning chatter became more serious. In a letter that Gabe and I wrote to friends and family in July 2011, I described, "The women who work at the hammam weep for Syria, for all the dead, for the disruption of normal life, and they support the president in every way. They most clearly distrust the hand of the United States in all of this, and its call for U.S. citizens to leave Syria, and its constant use of sanctions against Syria, in the blustering of Hillary and Barack and others, in its support of Israel and its butting into the affairs of Syria. They are well informed about the role of the United States in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the U.S. role with Israel. They said to me, 'We know that in the United States, you have people who sleep under bridges and people who can't get health care.' When my 60th birthday arrived, I decided to celebrate it there. But by fall 2011, our own Damascus began to be affected by the sounds of gunfire and explosions. Mustafa was angry one Sunday and said, 'What makes your country think they can tell us what to do? Do they think we don't know and hurt for what's happening in Syria? Why can't they keep out of it and let us fix our own Syria?' By 2012, no music was played in the morning at the hammam, and the women spoke in sad voices of the increasing violence. Instead of gossip and jokes, the conversation was more often than not about Al-Midan, a neighborhood southwest of the old city where there had been violence the previous night, or about an explosion in Qudsaya, one of the many neighborhoods that climbed the mountain along the Barada. Often they discussed the many people coming into Damascus to escape the destruction of their neighborhoods in Homs or Hama. A few weeks later, Mustafa lamented, 'We are just pawns in this chess game. The French, the United States, Saudi, Russia, everybody is acting like it's their country. No one cares about us.' As the academic year of Iraqi Student Project began to wind down mid-summer, I told Mustafa, Lena, Shakira, and Ahmed that Gabe and I would be leaving at the end of July and not returning. Mustafa bitterly predicted, 'In some years, you will return to this hammam. None of us will be here. And you will say, Allah irhamhon. God rest their souls.'" We came back to New York City September 8th, 2012, and we were, what can I say, kind of lost, you know? And we were fortunate in summer of 2015 that our teacher who taught us Arabic in the Muhayyem Yarmouk invited us to come to Istanbul. He had opened a center for Syrian youth and Palestinian Syrian youth who had made it past the border camps where many Syrians are, past the large city of Gaziantep where many more are, and they made it all the way to Istanbul. But the youth were without their families, in many cases young men who were trying to not get drafted by the regime or not pulled into militias by the many militias. And that summer of 2015, I did what I know best, teach writers workshop, do literature circles. Gabe did film and food and showed films on Friday night and had discussions. And I also worked in the children's program. And that summer was very amazing. And Mazen, the director, had said, now this isn't ISP, okay? Just do whatever the students need. And it was kind of that Paulo Freire pedagogy of the people. And what they wanted to do was learn English, become better writers, and read. And by the end of the summer, when we were leaving, some of them said, we know you, and you know how to get people to college. And we want you to do that for us. So we took the challenge, and I kept doing writers' workshop on Skype, and we worked with them the best we could from where we were in New York. And we put teachers in place at the center, at the Adar Center, where Mazen had brought us, and tried to keep a program going of learning English and work with these students. And happy to say that 6 students came in September, 1 to Manhattan College, run by the Christian Brothers, 1 to LaSalle University in Philadelphia, 1/3 to Webster University in St. Louis, Bluffton College, the Mennonite place in Ohio, 1 student to Lewis College, south of us here, Romeoville, and for the very first time in our life, we took a high school student. We had never done that, but this young man, Mohammed, was just amazing. And he's at the Quaker School in Philadelphia finishing his junior year of high school. We're still working with Syrians, and in September, we picked up 6 more Syrians to do the same thing. And already a student was accepted at Goucher College, and already the colleges were accepting students. Everything was going great. Then when the travel ban came, yeah, salam, now what? How do we get these young men here? And we thought, we're going to change. Let's go to plan B. Let's try to get to Canada. So right now we have succeeded in 6 Syrian students. We're calling it Syrian Student Project. And they've made it to acceptances at University of British Columbia, Vancouver Island University, and Seneca College in Toronto. So on the back of your handout, if some people say, golly, how can we help? There is a little paragraph if you wish to help. And that's where we are now. And I think we're ready for questions. Dave?
It's a book with 2 authors. How did you write it together? Just a few paragraphs, different sections?
Do you want to explain that? Different sections? Well, we're Gabe and Teresa. So Gabe did a lot of the sidebars that are really historical and explain, how can I say it, Gabe? And I did the hammam. We did it together. How would you describe it? But we're still
well, there. I took the letters and marked up passages I thought could be important, and meanwhile we evolved a kind of an order for the book based on the 4 areas we lived in and grouping some subjects under each area. And then finding the letters in the end served to jar the memory more than anything else. It basically, not too much copy could just go in. So that was, it was a lot of writing, and the parts that Teresa had been the main person in, Writer's Workshop, the chapter on literature circles,
Mazen.
The hammam, an interview with our teacher, Mazen Rabia. So, and then we both went over everything, and the looking, you know, by that time we had a publisher, more or less, and Just World Books, and we had to struggle for certain things like that title and the cover and the maps and the sidebars and many things. But I think it came out to be a pretty good book. But that's kind of how we took it as far as we took it, and then they gave it to an editor who went back and forth with us on things, and so the end came. Yeah, tell them about that.
And sometimes we had to go away. So we went to Pendle Hill, the Quaker Retreat Center near Philadelphia, and we worked there. And Gabe was upstairs and I was downstairs, and then we would switch and read each other's work. And then one week, Gabe said, you know, I'm really stuck on this one part. There's too many distractions. I need to go away again. And I said, okay, how about Stony Point Center? It's an hour and a half north of New York City. It's a beautiful Peace and Justice Interfaith Center. And Gabe said, that's great. Okay, I'll go get a backpack. I said, okay, I'll get my stuff. And he said, you're one of the distractions.
You did.
But I also want to say, one of the fights with our editor was how we did the acknowledgments, because I didn't want to say every single person's name. Because how would I put every single one of your names? So if you do get the book, look in the back, and it has categories of people. So it says St. Nicholas. It says Neighbors for Peace. It has Voices in the Wilderness. People who ran internet cafes. People who believed in us. People who visited us. Because remember, people, Rosalie, Elizabeth Murtick, Dale, many folks from your circles have come to visit us in Syria. And so... but we did leave a square open, so if you do buy the book, we can write your name right there, okay?
Yes, how many students actually did finish and return to Iraq?
We had three students return to Iraq. One from Grinnell went to Baghdad and lives with his mother and was doing computer. The student from Loyola, Sarab, many of you know her, and she also returned to Iraq. Her sister, Sama, from Grinnell. Currently, they were working in a school and teaching in the in Erbil. So those are the three.
There are a number who, during the time they were here, during the time some of them were here, their families were resettled in Canada, in the U.S., in Finland, in Australia, I don't know where all. And for the most part, they graduated from, they did their undergraduate work and are living with their families. There's, I've never quite figured, I think it's about half, either have or are in the process of getting master's degrees. So they're still on their F-1 visa here. That there are, the one who's a dentist that Teresa mentioned, he was from the first group. Another is in a PhD program at UMass in Amherst. Well, it's actually in Worcester, in bio something or other. But he loves it. You know, they're paying him now instead of all of us raising money for him, because he's doing the normal master's process of research and helping their projects. And some of you might have met Saif, who went to a college in Montana, which seemed like a tough place for an Iraqi to go. He did really wonderful. He soon discovered himself as a poet in English. He did poetry slams a lot. He got some of his poems published, graduated, and is in a master's program in film. And What was the recent thing? He's in-
and most recently, he was given a grant by the Tribeca Film Festival. He and his brother were awarded $10,000 for a film that they're doing. And that film has been shown in Brazil and Paris and a few other places. So I think it'd be really amazing to have a book that tells about each of the Iraqi Student Project students and what they're doing.
The brother is in Iraq, and he's here, and they work by Skype back and forth on these projects.
Wasn't there once discussion about a film or a documentary? Wasn't that?
There still is discussion about a film or documentary. Anya says, do we want to say anything about the current state of affairs overall?
Of Syria?
Mm-hmm. But you have to use the microphone.
Well, I mean, it's a great tragedy. I mean, it's just a huge tragedy. And what the woman in the hammam said, you know, this isn't about us fighting each other. It's Saudi and Qatar and Russia Turkey and the U.S. to some extent fighting Russia and Iran and different militias, different groups, but as well as the Syrian military. I mean, it's gone through terrible times. I mean, the Syria was about 20 million, 21 million people in 2011. The best estimates are that only half of those live now where they lived then. 4 to 5 million are refugees outside Syria, most of them in Turkey, some in Lebanon, some in Iraq, some in Jordan. And within the internally displaced, who at this point could be internally displaced for several reasons, one of which, though, being was in those early stages, there was massive destruction of the housing. The housing built in the last, 20, 30 years is made to fall down, and it fell down in huge areas when the government shelled areas where the opposition, the violent opposition, the Free Syrian Army, had made some attack on a police station, a military outpost in some area. Then that whole area would be leveled. Not at that stage by bombs from airplanes, but by shells fired. And this was apparent to us. People were saying they did not want the Free Syrian Army to come and, quotes, protect them, because it was a sign their places would be destroyed, their neighborhood or their village. The turn toward violence in the fall, say, of 2011, 6 months or so after the regime had used violence against nonviolent protesters, the nonviolent coordinating committees had come about with amazing quickness with internet communication from village to village and neighborhood to neighborhood of what would be done, what silent standing after Friday services in the mosque would be done. And the response of the regime continued to be killing people or taking prisoners. But, yeah, I want to come to that. But, I mean, to get to now is a complicated thing. You know, and when we were still there in 2012, the UN and the Arab League asked Kofi Annan to go into Syria, by then retired from being head of the UN. And, you know, what could be done? And Kofi Annan called for the involved parties and kind of the powers in the world to, you know, sit down together. And the U.S., Hillary and Barack both said, in more or less just straightforward words, not if Assad sits at the table. Well, it's not the way it's usually done. But that was our stand from even before that, it was that he had to go. It was a totally inaccurate analysis of the, Syria. Fine, he has to go. What comes then? Should they have been in power for 40 years, his father and him? No, I'm sure not. But you still have to do something that's real afterwards. Instead, it became this multiplicity of militias, each with their own, you know, different point and different person, different country who would give them arms through Turkey and so on. Turkey was miffed that Al-Assad had not responded to the Turkish pleas in the beginning and began to open the border to all this. I mean, the involvement of the U.S. is not as evident as the involvement of Russia, and not as visible, I guess I should say. But it was key at that moment, and it's been present ever since. And I'm talking about even before the ISIS seizing that land, and once again we're going to settle something by bombing. It's worked so well before, right? So if some part of it can be stabilized, that's probably the most we can hope for at this time. You know, it's not a prison. People go in and out of Damascus. They go to Lebanon. I mean, not as refugees, but on business to keep things going, and other points of crossing into Lebanon and Turkey. But meanwhile, there's this immense refugee problem, and people at this point are saying, we're never going to be able to go back. We better figure what's next, you know, whether that's learn Turkish or try to get to Europe. But the U.S. has given a pretty clear message there also.
Well, Assad.
Do you?
She said, do we care to share our perception of Assad?
Yeah.
I don't. I'm not good at that. Do you want to do that?
Well,
I don't even want to share it of most presidents that we know.
The thing about Bashar al-Assad, who became president in 2000 after his Hafiz, his father, died suddenly after more or less being in charge of the government for 30 years. And not a corrupt person, I think, but much corruption around him. And this man, who looks like the least likely president to do the things he's done, was not doing them in the beginning. There was the Syrian Spring back in 2001 and 2. Didn't last so long. There were other changes, though, that he didn't make. I mean, he clearly moved away from the socialist model, and some people were making a lot of money, and there were, as we lived there, seeing, you know, more and more big cars, more and more traffic, and so on. But he also was not hidden away. He lived in a neighborhood not so far from where we lived at one point. And he and his wife would often be at different openings or the opera or whatever. They drove his own car.
His mom
was living next door there where she had lived with her husband when Hafez was president. And so it was not like, it was hard to believe. And like 2 months into the protests, March, April, maybe in May of 2011, all of a sudden, all of us felt hopeful because he was going to address Parliament, and there was like leaks from the people around him that he was going to do some of these things. And he did almost nothing in that speech except, you know, get applause for saying, you know, how tough Syria was going to be and we'll win and so on. And as a matter, I mean, he did some things as stuff went on. He changed, he took off the law, the, what do we call it in this country?
State of emergency.
Yeah, state of emergency, martial law kind of thing. But it didn't matter a whole lot by that time because, you know, military were everywhere anyway. The hard thing has been, I mean, when we, the last few months we were living there in September, the man who lived below us, an Egyptian, had it and went back to Cairo. And within weeks, that apartment, well, within days, a family from Hama moved in because Hama was being bombed at that time. A mother,
four children,
and then other relatives, other mothers and children came for short periods of time from other areas that were dangerous, and lived there. The population of Damascus right now is greater than it's ever been in history, larger than it's ever been in history. I mean, because in that narrow strip that runs north and south, mostly in the east, but not necessarily to the eastern border, that's where the population is, more than it ever was, and it always was mostly there. Aleppo, Hama, Homs, Damascus, and many smaller cities.
I always carry this when we give our talks. This little bauble is from the cell phone of our neighbor downstairs. So the day we were leaving, she said, I want to give you something. And she tore this off her cell phone and handed it to me. So I always keep that with us to remember. It was the one mother from Hama, her sister from Homs, and the other sister from Medan, and all of their kids. And when Ramadan came, in this total time of war and suffering and not much to share, we heard this little knock at our door, and two girls from her family came, and they brought Gabe and I food for iftar to break the fast for Ramadan, to bring it up to these two strangers upstairs to feed us. That's the generosity of these people.
Yeah, let me, on the booklet, you don't have to look at it now, but this is a very recent book, The Battle for Syria, International Rivalry in the New Middle East. This is a British historian, Christopher Phillips, writing. And much of the publishing that's been done about Syria is pretty heavy from one side or the other, and is not so well written or translated. This is a book of thorough research of how, from the start, the regional powers and the world powers were involved in this. You know, the U.S., we act like, well, Russia, why'd they turn to Russia? Well, thousands of Syrians were educated for college degrees and doctors and everything in Russia in the Cold War times. And thousands of Russian wives and mothers live in Damascus and Aleppo and other cities there. The Russian Cultural Center was a wonderful place to go. The other cultural centers, the Goethe Center and the Cervantes Center and the French and U.S. didn't do too much, but they had a language center, British Council. But the Russian center was all kinds of things because it was a country they had a relationship with through all these years. Anyway, I think, maybe I'm wrong, but I think he tells a pretty accurate, well-researched story of how Syria became this deadly battleground with really nothing spared through these years.
In addition to that book, if you just want to know more about the Middle East in general, a very easy way is if you subscribe to Aramco World. It has beautiful resources, articles, supplements, and a calendar of events in various cities in the United States and abroad to see art and culture of the Middle East. And these papers, if you take one, tells you how to subscribe for free. The quilt you see over here is from Bosra, the Roman theater town that's in the slides, and we brought it just because it's beautiful. And we brought these because they're beautiful. You could talk to us about them. Made in Syria.
Damascus.
Gabe is reminding me that the word damask, when we talk about damask fabric, it means Damascus. So, and in the back is Bookends and Beginnings to Sell Our Book, the map up here. The words on that curtain were a result of a writer's workshop where students defined more about prayer when they were asked by a director of documentaries named Pennebaker, who had done a film on Dylan, and he came to Damascus to show the film from back in the day. And when he asked the students about being in the mosque and prayer, they had comments that were so profound that we asked them to put them on the cloth. So stick around if you can and buy some books. We'll be here to sign them. And you're invited to continue the conversation across the street. Thank you for coming.